Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast presentation titled Dyskinesia, Importance of Giving Patients More Good On Time in Parkinson's Disease. I'm Dr. Stuart Isaacson, and I'm the director of the Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center of Boca Raton in Boca Raton, Florida.
Hi, and I'm Rajesh Pawar. I'm professor of neurology and director of the Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center from the University of Kansas Medical Center in Kansas City, Kansas.
Today, our discussion will focus on the management of dyskinesia and on providing good on time in Parkinson's disease. We'll share practical tips for early identification and treatment of dyskinesia and our experience with current treatment. Joining us in this conversation is Dr. Fiona Gupta. She is the director of the Division of Movement Disorders at New York Neurology Associates in New York. Thanks so much for joining us, Fiona, and let's begin.
Maybe we can begin with you, Fiona,
and really think about some of these commonly used words that sort of define our patients' experiences day to day with Parkinson's disease, perhaps unfortunately with these words, but these words of on and off and motor fluctuations and such. How do you talk to your patients, and how do you teach your peers about how to understand and define what is on time and what is off time?
Thank you so much. And you're absolutely right. It is very tricky, both for our patients to often identify what is off and on, and even for our fellow clinicians. You know, when we have words like off and on and dyskinesia, and tremor, and then motor fluctuations. And as you know, within the context of motor fluctuations, there's different types of off, wearing off, morning akinesia, prolonged on, unpredictable. It can be very convoluted. So I really am a big proponent of, really taking our patients through a day in their life, talking to them about what it's like when they take their medication, what gets better, what happens when the medication wears off, when there's a return of symptoms. That often helps to define what off versus on is. And then, you know, if they're having dyskinesia, really trying to demonstrate, maybe show videos, asking what they feel to determine what dyskinesia versus tremor is like. Tremor might be more rhythmic, and when the meds wear down, dyskinesia is a little bit more dance-like or loose or writhing. And you want to time it out to the medication. Videos can be very helpful, even if a patient is taking a home video. And if you do have the time, oftentimes having patients come into the office off medications, and then, you know, determining how they UPDRS or how they look off medications, and then having them do an on eval at some point as well. So I think both subjectively, it's about talking to our patients, talking to our colleagues, and also objectively, really kind of doing a good thorough examination, whether it is video based or in office.
Yeah, you know, our patients find all these terms very challenging, especially if they have not experienced any of these conditions. And one thing we do try to teach our patients, as you know, is just because you don't have on and off or dyskinesia is not, the medications are not working. It's actually a good thing. I also kind of try to go through a day for my patients. I say, how are you when you wake up? Are you doing pretty good or not? What happens after you take your medicines? Do you notice a change? Does your medicine last until the next dose? Do you have certain doses that just do not work at all from that part? So I think all these are important things. And I personally like to start asking them before they even have it. So once they have it, then they can call and say, you know what? My medicine is not lasting till the next dose. I start noticing, a tremor or slowness or change in my handwriting or whatever it could be from that part. So I think that really helps a patient repeating things even when they don't have those going on. And for dyskinesia, as I often tell them, do you have any, involuntary movements? Because that's another challenge our patients have. Are the dyskinesias. So when you have a patient with dyskinesias, is there a typical experience the patients have?
Well, you know, I think overall it's very important for us to ask about just the subjective impairment. I still think, and this is a big misconception, sometimes you hear, oh, patients would rather be dyskinetic because that means they're on. And, you know, that's not necessarily the case. I have a lot of patients that have really troublesome dyskinesia to the point where it's, you know, they can't even sit in a restaurant, or they're limited, you know, going out socially, or it's very unpredictable and they feel a social stigma. So, you know, I like to differentiate my patients' experiences between, you know, dyskinesia that's bothersome or troublesome versus those that might be more manageable. So I think it's really important not just to take into account the quantity or the capacity of the dyskinesia, but also ask about quality and how it impacts just in general regular activities of daily living. Obviously, we want our patients to be out and about and socializing and active. And if dyskinesia is a limiting factor, I think it is important to really kind of discuss that with patients and determine a good treatment paradigm.
It really brings up this idea that we often choose, or and have our patients have to choose between being on or being off. But really, on can be compromised. It could be suboptimal on, as far as you point out, on with troublesome dyskinesia. Fiona pointed that out. I think patients just want to have a good on time, that on time without troublesome dyskinesia. And we're trying to educate our patients to really think about their day, not in terms of when the medicine isn't working with off, but when is the medicine working well, giving benefit? And how long does it take for that benefit to occur after you take a dose? And what's the duration of benefit? And what symptoms occur when there's no longer benefit from a dose of medication? And then in that context, I like to ask our patients, when you're getting benefit from a dose of medicine, do you then ever have any movements while you're getting benefit? So hopefully over time, we can move away from some of these binary terms of on and off and talk more about the quality of their experiences during the day.
And you know, we talk about on time, off time, time with dyskinesias, time they are asleep. But really, some of the price that our patients pay for being on are some dyskinesias that the patients may not even notice. And that's why, you know, I like to use the term on with non-troublesome dyskinesias or on without troublesome, kind of putting them together, because it's fine when they are on with a little bit of dyskinesias as long as they are functioning. As Fiona mentioned, it's really the troublesome dyskinesias that become very challenging for our patients, where they cannot function due to the dyskinesias.
Of course, we always focus on a so-called peak dose dyskinesia that occurs when someone is having their good on or their best on time. But dyskinesia can occur between doses, the so-called DID pattern, which is really a remnant of too little medication. And then we always have those patients who are really troublesome when they have both the off symptoms of tremor and dyskinesia at the same time.
And that can be very challenging, trying for some of our patients to differentiate tremor and dyskinesias. Fiona, do you have some tricks that you tell your patients to see how they can differentiate them?
Yeah, it's challenging, not just for patients. You're absolutely right, Stu and Raj, but even for clinicians. As a movement specialist, I'm sure that you agree with me that we all see patients that are on, you know, excessive amounts of levodopa, when in turn, the clinician they might've been seeing was actually treating dyskinesia and mistaking it for tremor. And so I think really it's important to, you know, I often, you know, will demonstrate or sometimes show videos to patients of the differences between tremor and dyskinesia. I know when we do the teaching for our students, it's really important to also, you know, really kind of discern that these are different entities, different symptoms, and the treatment is different. Again, I do like doing, if possible, the off-on examination in the office where we video it, so we can really give patients a good understanding of what's dyskinesia, what's off. And as Stu mentioned, there can be peak dose, but there's also the DID, diphasic. So I think from a subjective standpoint, really just talking to patients, you know, showing demos or videos, and then objectively really trying to capture them in the office at certain stages, whether it's off or on, it's really helpful. And I think, again, teaching, you know, our fellow clinicians just on the differences, because it does make a big difference overall for our treatment decisions going forward for these patients.
I think one of the challenges really comes down, and you might be fortunate in having patients sit for extended period of time, but I think an average neurologist doesn't have that luxury to keep patients in the clinic or bring them off and then on and watch how long they have dyskinesias. Or the patient may call and say, "Oh, I'm moving," and again, is it tremor or is it dyskinesia? That also can definitely be extremely challenging for the patient. I mean, some of the tricks I personally use is try to ask them, is it rhythmical? Can you predict what the next movement is going to be? Are these involuntary movements? If they have tremor, are these involuntary movements other than the tremors? Are you dancing? Or asking the patient to actually tell me what these movements are. And the thing is, some patients are so good, they'll stand up and they'll try to kind of move their body and all. And it's like, okay, that is really dyskinesias, or, move their head to kind of actually demonstrate it for us. And, at times I may actually have them do a videotape of 30 seconds or something so that I can look at it and see what it is. But like, Stu, you mentioned that the challenge also comes is when patients have both, have the tremor in their hands and dyskinesias in the trunk, that can be a real challenge, not only trying to diagnose it or trying to even differentiate, is it all tremor or is it both?
Yeah, I like the video idea. We've resorted to that as well quite a bit. We do in-office, on-off evaluations, as Fiona does. But we're also now taking the tact where somebody comes with a family member and they're describing these periods, say, well, just take a short video because the video is time-stamped. And as long as you know what time they took the medicine on the first video, we can see every half an hour a snippet of what they're looking like in their motor state. And of course, we've worked hard on trying to identify wearables that can help educate us as to our patients' days, and certainly the wearables as they emerge, especially I think when combined with AI, will really begin to help us see when patients are having bradykinesia and tremor, periods when they're having dyskinesia, and when the dyskinesia seems to be more severe and may impact their daily activities. And I think will lead to us considering treatment options sooner.
Yeah, I agree. I think wearables are still very underutilized. I mean, I'll say I'm the first one who's not utilizing it as much as I can. And the thing with wearables is that, one, it has to be a passive thing, that patient doesn't have to actually do something while it is being recorded. And something we have it on as part of our life. And I think the wearables that are like on an Apple or a watch, so to speak, are really the one I think would really help patients, because I'm surprised I see so many more patients wearing these watches that all they need to do is download an app that we can actually track how they're doing during the day.
Yeah, it's really important to really understand the patient's experiences. We often overlook dyskinesia. As Fiona points out, many times we think patients would rather be dyskinetic than off, but I think in reality, they'd rather be neither. And rather have good on time throughout the waking day and into the evening and nights and such. And you can imagine someone trying to prepare breakfast and scramble an egg when they're having dyskinesia, and how messy that could get, or when they're trying to walk or trying to get effective physical therapy and they're dyskinetic and impact some of their balance exercises and they lose out on that therapy session. Down here in Florida, we have patients who play a lot of golf, pickleball, and the dyskinesia impacts their ability to participate in these hobbies and these recreational activities and exercise. So I think it's really important to understand not just if dyskinesia is occurring or when it's occurring, but how it impacts different activities for each individual.
Absolutely. I'm such a proponent of that, especially, obviously advocating for our patients to be social and out and about. Down there, you have pickleball and golf. Up here, we have Broadway and theater. And I've had, so many patients just not be able to, they need to take their medication to go to the theater, but they're really self-conscious because of the dyskinesia, and really is something that is a great source withdrawal for them and really unfortunate, especially those that are really passionate about the arts. So I agree, it's not necessarily about the timing or the severity. A lot of it is really just the overall impact on our patients and their just, you know, quality of life and what their hobbies are.
I was going to say, you know, you brought up the issue of their activities, whether it's cooking or eating and all that. But you're right, it's the balance that they are moving, especially with Parkinson's, the balance is affected, they're falling, it puts them at a higher risk. These movements call people to have pains, you know, neck pain, back pain, weight loss. I mean, that's my other thing I struggle with patients is my patients who really have bad dyskinesias are really losing weight. And then the whole embarrassment factor, like you said, these people, you know, they're off, they try to take an extra medicine to go to the Broadway, and then they don't like to sit in the Broadway or go to a family member because they're embarrassed, they're moving all the time. They don't want to be that person everyone is looking and seeing, you know, why or what's wrong with this person. Because as a society, we are not very kind to people who are, you know, just having these extra movements and trying to figure out what's going on rather than saying maybe something medically is wrong and this person is doing the best that they can.
I think another impact that's often overlooked too is that dyskinesia never occurs in isolation. It's accompanied by off. And patients begin to spend more and more time either without benefit of a dose of medication in the off state or with benefit in dyskinesia that reduces the full benefit that they get during the on state, and they spend less and less time in a good on state. And this idea that when you're seeing dyskinesia, there's also off that's probably being undertreated, because in the past we've had to choose between a trade-off of giving less medication to lower dyskinesia, but then having more off, or increasing medicine to improve off, but then having more dyskinesia. And this trade-off, I think, inhibited both patients, but also I think ourselves in our clinics from being able to properly manage patients over time to focus on extending the duration of good on and always trying to avoid, we're trying to minimize this trade-off. I think it's one of the exciting things about having medications that are being studied in clinical trials for dyskinesia and having the medication that's been approved by the FDA to treat dyskinesia now. We can really begin to highlight the impact dyskinesia has on our patients and on our treatment regimens and treat dyskinesia when needed.
And the other thing, because of levodopa phobia, how many patients don't even start treatment because they are concerned that they may develop levodopa-induced dyskinesias down the road because we really didn't have any approved medicines, and trying to convince the patients that the dyskinesias can be managed because you need the levodopa to keep going, to being independent, to improving your activities was difficult. But I think other than, like you said, the patient deciding between on and off, it's also patients delaying treatment because they are concerned about the dyskinesias.
Yeah, so, I would agree with that. Definitely this phobia is still, and I think it's really up to us to counsel patients effectively on that. I am surprised how many patients are really delaying when they can benefit from levodopa because of this fear of. So I agree with that 100%.
Yeah. What happens when patients confuse tremor and dyskinesia in the sense of they report that they're having more tremor, but they mean dyskinesia? Or even more problematic, often they report having more dyskinesia when they really are having more tremor. It can really confuse the treatment, especially when it's on a phone call. And often we'll add a medicine to try to reduce off, and somebody will call up and say, that medicine's not working, I have more tremor. How do you try to teach them that?
Yeah, again, invariably, this is so difficult because it does change clinical management in the wrong direction, right? If we're treating dyskinesia oftentimes, but really it's tremor or vice versa. So again, really try to use words like Raj mentioned. Is it actually rhythmic? Is it tremor? Show them, you know, what we think of a tremor versus dancing, writhing movements, really getting a good feel for what dyskinesia is versus not. videos, I think, are important. I do agree with you, wearables, you know, now or in the future, are really going to emerge. But this is still a big challenge because, again, it dictates clinical management in a different direction.
And at times, you know, how often does it happen when you think it is tremor, you cut back the medicine, the other way, you think it's dyskinesia as you cut back the medicine and the patient calls saying they're much worse. So that at times helps me saying, oh, really, this was actually tremors and not dyskinesia. So let me go ahead and actually give them less medicine rather than more medicine or the other way around. So at times, I think we just end up trying a medication and kind of going along with it. But you know, the other thing is our goal eventually is to help the patients who have the dyskinesias, give them more good on time. That is on without dyskinesias or on with non-troublesome dyskinesias. And you know, Fiona, do you look at, like Stu mentioned, we have peak dose dyskinesias, we have diaphasic dyskinesias, we have off dystonia. How are you going to manage these differently? Or you have like one size fits all that you have dyskinesia, so let's just manage it so and so way.
Oh, no, absolutely no one size fits all. As you know, with Parkinson's, for any patient, it's so heterogeneous. There's no exact template. No ingredients of A, B, C, or D. You really have to approach each patient differently and really individualize each patient almost in a precision medicine approach. So there's a lot of avenues you can take. Obviously, you know, we can change around the levodopa dosing, fractionate doses, change intervals, and so on. I'm a big proponent of adjunctive medication for dyskinesia if need be. Obviously, surgical therapies are an important consideration, but definitely no one size fits all. You really have to get to know your patients, the type of dyskinesia, the severity, the bothersome nature, in addition to the off time and other symptoms, and then make your clinical decisions, you know, jointly, obviously with patients and caregivers, and really try to come up with the best plan forward.
So how would you look at peak dose as far as treating is it concerned compared to a diaphasic one? Is there more likely you would cut down their medicine or
peak dose? I might fractionate the medication, maybe smaller doses, a little bit more frequently. I try to really get a good feel for how the time after taking levodopa does it occur. But I'm going to really try to, again, really be very smooth with my flow. Diaphasic, again, I might treat more in the opposite direction where you're trying to promote, you know, more on time. But again, change around levodopa. But for both peak dose and diaphasic, especially the more troublesome, I'm going to go to adjunctive therapy, you know, such as amantadine or amantadine extended release. I just think oftentimes if you're shaking up the patient's underlying levodopa regimen too much, you might go in one direction or the other. So I have a low propensity to try an adjunctive therapy. And then there's obviously other advanced therapies, including surgical options, deep brain stimulation for certain patients as well. But I will try to use this rational polypharmacy approach, not just a one-size-fits-all or one medication, and really try to rely on that. Let's see what we can use with various mechanisms to try to get, you know, the best quality of on for our patients without the troublesome dyskinesia.
So Fiona, you mentioned the amantadine extended release, delayed release formulation that's commercially available now. Raj, has this been a game changer for you? I mean, is this something you use first line? How do you approach it, decide to treat?
Yeah, so to me, you know, like Fiona mentioned, cutting down their doses of levodopa used to be, you know, one of our first options we used to try. But I think that the challenge behind that I personally would end up with is at times cutting down their dose of levodopa either did not give them a good on or the patient had more off time. And they would call back and say, yeah, I tried that and I would rather be on a full pill or whatever the dose might have been because I just didn't like how I feel. So to me, the amantadine DR-ER really was a game changer because it offered us an adjunctive therapy where we clearly were able to show not only the severity of dyskinesia got better, but also the duration of dyskinesia got less. And I think for the patients, not only did they have to worry that, oh, if I take this, I'm going to have more time, more off time. Here now it was a situation that they are on time, or the good on time, that is on time without dyskinesias plus on time without troublesome dyskinesias, increased significantly. And like you saw in our clinical trials, we were able to increase it by about 2.5 hours over placebo, which to me was itself a big game changer, that I could now add a drug that actually reduced their off time and dyskinesia. So to me, that was a big step forward in the management of Parkinson's and dyskinesias.
I think it's also interesting that it has a dual indication, the delayed release, extended release, bedtime dose of amantadine, in that it's not only has an indication for dyskinesia, but also a separate indication for off. So while we spend so much time trying to distinguish between whether there's off and tremor or dyskinesia, and which one should we address, and what the trade-off might be in trying to treat one and will we worsen the other and vice versa, with this delayed release, extended release formulation of amantadine, we don't have that trade-off. We can actually, in a sense, have our cake and eat it also. You can treat off and dyskinesia just with this once daily bedtime dose. So I think that's been a big, big help, because now we don't have to worry about our patients necessarily confusing the issue and driving treatment in one path. And what really struck me from the trial was that after just 2 weeks on taking the delayed and extended release formulation, patients had almost 4 hours more a day of good on time. I think it really focused on this idea for our patients to get as consistent good on time, infusion-like, if you will. We have these infusions that hopefully will be approved this year that will help maintain patients in a good on. And I think you can do this with this medication and improve the good on. It went from, in the research programs, about half the day patients were spending good on and the other half with troublesome dyskinesia or off. And after 2 weeks of the delayed release, extended release formulation of amantadine, they were spending 3/4 of their day in a good on state, 4 hours more a day. So I think that's a big difference. Unfortunately, for the generic amantadine that's taken multiple times a day, we don't have any data to compare it to. It hasn't been studied in this way. So we only have this singular medication that we can think about in this way.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, so a couple of things, like you said, when our patients call and say they're having extra movements, and if we are not sure, is it tremor or dyskinesias, is the patient having more off, or is the patient having more time with dyskinesias? I think amantadine DRER is a great option to use in these patients, because no matter what, we should see an improvement, whether it's off or dyskinesias. And the other thing is, you know, to me, amantadine IR, you know, there is some data out there for dyskinesias, but if you look at the data for off time, really, it does not show that it helps off time. And, you know, I have people who bring up the issue, why would it not? And I don't have an answer to it. Maybe it's a pharmacokinetic, maybe how it is delivered. You know, the part about amantadine DRER is that because it's taken at night, the levels slowly go up during the night. And when the patient wakes up in the morning, the levels are pretty high. It's kind of the highest for the day, so to speak, and then the levels slowly come down, as opposed to amantadine IR, where the patient wakes up in the morning, takes their dose, the levels go up, the levels come down, and maybe that's part of the benefit, is the extended improvement that they get with amantadine DRER that we just cannot duplicate with IR, especially with the off time. So to me, you know, any patient who has off and dyskinesias, first of all, I think amantadine DRER is a classic medication to kind of use. And the other one is patients who are just having real bad dyskinesias. Fiona, what do you think?
You know, I agree. And I think the proof is just in what our patients tell us. I had a patient the other day who on ER Mantadini ER said, you know what, I feel like it hit the bullseye. It really kicks in when I needed it the most, which was in those, you know, morning hours. He's able to go to now, you know, his physical therapy and boxing classes and things like that, and is not so impacted. So I definitely agree. I think a lot of it is could be pharmacokinetics, but really just in general, like, you know, something that's going to cover throughout the day, especially those most vulnerable hours when we want our patients to be active. And it is nice, you know, I think in our toolkit and our arsenal of various therapies that we have, whether levodopa or adjunctive therapy, we do have, you know, choices to make. But exactly, having that dual anti-dyskinetic effect, but also improvement in on time, you're not struggling to kind of say it's one or the other. And so you can really, you know, it's definitely a go-to for me just because of both. And especially with the uncertainty, is it off related? Is it off tremor? Is it dyskinesia, peak dose, diphasic? At least you don't have to put so much work into kind of that guessing game. You can usually, you know, you can make the treatment decision and then go from there. So, but really it's also listening to our patients and hearing what they say with their experiences.
So is there an ideal patient for you where you would consider this therapy as adjunctive?
You know, again, I think you have to reach deep into your toolkit and find, you know, what is going to be the best for a patient when you're making the treatment decision. Someone is on levodopa, experiencing dyskinesia, is on a, you know, a stable levodopa course where you don't want to shuffle it around too much because you run the chance of promoting more off time or, you know, it disrupts their day. For me, it really is, you know, someone that is having dyskinesia. It doesn't have to be, you know, severe or too moderate. It's really just a dyskinesia that's present and potentially bothersome to them. But also, you know, that you're kind of fluctuating between on and off. So I think it's really a pretty universal group that could benefit from a mechanism and a drug like this. I use it quite early in my arsenal for adjunctive therapy.
Yeah, I like to think about patients also who have had previous dyskinesia, because whenever we add medication, whether it's increasing the dose or frequency of levodopa, using extended release levodopa formulation, or adding any adjunctive on extender, there's that risk of developing dyskinesia, probably around 15 or 20%, with all medications that have an approval for off, except for the delayed release, extended release amantadine, where the dyskinesia is actually not increased and will be decreased. So I think anyone who's had prior dyskinesia that has limited their therapy, anyone who has dyskinesia that impacts their daily activities or their management of underlying off episodes, are patients who can really benefit from this. I think there's one caveat we should mention about amantadine. It's renally cleared. And for this reason, in patients who are over the age of 70 or 75, they all have impaired renal or slowed renal clearance. We should begin, I think, this medication at a lower dose. Raj, you mentioned that the IR formulation, as you take it multiple times a day, may build up towards the evening and nighttime hours, and this has caused sleep disorders, vivid dreams, increasing of REM sleep behavior disorder, behaviors and activities, fragmented sleep. This delayed release, extended release formulation of amantadine was actually time dependent driven, so that when you take it at bedtime, nothing happens with these pellets in the capsules for about 3 or 4 hours, and then gradually they open up, as you point out, and when you wake up, you have a high level. Maybe it's the high level that's associated with improving often dyskinesia. Maybe it's the steady pharmacokinetics in the plasma over the waking day. I also wonder whether it can just be due to having a more constant blockade of those glutamatergic NMDA receptors in the brain that's the target of amantadine, as opposed to the pulsatile blockade you might get with the immediate release formulation that's responsible. But I think it's a nice treatment option to have for our patients. Any advice, Fiona, you'd like to share with clinicians managing dyskinesia as we close here?
Well, I think we're all in this together. Again, this is something we all learn from each other. I think getting the terminology right, really getting to know your patients. Again, I always say a day in the life of our patients. Oftentimes it's like, you know, good hours and what hours are better than the others, and really taking our patients through and just listening to them overall. So I think, yes, there's a lot of terminology. There's a lot of treatment decisions. very heterogeneous condition, as we know, with no one size fits all approach. But I think really just listening to our patients, learning lots of case studies, understanding the various mechanisms are so important. And then just looking forward, you know, not just with our current, but also future treatment trends and staying on top of everything. But, you know, it's always a learning process, but I think we're all in it together.
Great, Raj, Fiona, it's great chatting with you today about dyskinesia, and it's great we have a treatment option for our patients. And thank you all for joining and listening in. Hope you found this educational.